You're listening to a Get Abstract summary of The New Jim Crow, a book by Michelle Alexander. Michelle Alexander's 2010 indictment of America's penal system helped spark a new generation of civil rights and prison reform abolition activism, including the Black Lives Matter movement. It influenced the work of countless racial justice activists and educators. Alexander, a civil rights attorney and legal scholar, makes a compelling case that far from having transcended race, the U.S. criminal justice system has deliberately consigned millions of people of color to a new form of discrimination, disenfranchisement, and stigma. The first takeaway is racial caste in the United States didn't end after Jim Crow. It just took a new form, the penal system. Even before America became a country in 1776, its elites depended on the concept of race as a tool to divide poor people and keep them from uniting in revolt. Near the end of the 17th century, wealthy planters introduced racial caste by offering poor whites a racial bribe, giving poor whites privileges withheld from black slaves. The bribes included certain measures that gave poor white servants direct power over black slaves. Race-based division and control persists today, but the system has transformed to adapt to social changes. After the abolition of slavery, the caste system reformed into Jim Crow, the system of laws and practices that ensured racial segregation and discrimination throughout the South, disenfranchisement of black people, and the continuance of the divide between poor whites and blacks. Jim Crow gradually collapsed over the course of the 20th century. The 1960s saw poor whites and blacks begin to converge as the civil rights movement gave birth to a poor people's movement. By that time, however, a new racial order had begun to take shape. The law and order rhetoric of the 1950s presaged whites elites seizing on fear of crime as a pretext for crackdowns on black communities during the 60s and early 70s. During the 1980s, America's penal system emerged as the new system of racial control. Bias in law enforcement and sentencing has created a new racial undercast made up of prisoners, probationers, and parolees. These individuals, disproportionately people of color, face disenfranchisement, discrimination, social shame, and stigma, and are rendered inferior under the law in terms of rights and privileges. The second takeaway is the war on drugs made drug offenses the centerpiece of the American penal system. In 1982, President Ronald Reagan announced America's war on drugs, appealing to racial resentment covertly through the racialization and demonization of certain criminals and welfare recipients. Only 2% of Americans then viewed drugs as an important issue. Crack, the formulation of cocaine that became associated with urban African-American neighborhoods, had not yet hit the streets. A media blitz accompanying the war on drugs focused on crack cocaine after the drug's emergence in 1985. This media frenzy promoted false and misleading claims about crack's dangers and the prevalence of crack use among blacks. It fueled racial stereotypes regarding drug use and welfare fraud. New federal drug policies enacted in 1988 imposed unprecedented penalties for drug crimes, including harsh sentences for people with no prior record and the death penalty for certain offenses. Under the Anti-Drug Abuse Act, even non-participants in crimes could find themselves evicted from public housing merely for allowing drug-related criminal activity to occur. In the 1990s, the Clinton administration extended America's drug laws. Then-President Bill Clinton created the so-called Three Strikes Law, under which a conviction on a third offense carries a mandatory life sentence. Clinton's 1994 crime bill also added new capital crimes, beefed up state and local police forces, and budgeted billions of dollars to build prisons. The war on drugs continued in the 21st century. More than 60% of the increase in prison population from 2000 to 2010 resulted from drug convictions. Judging by its effects, the war on drugs exists primarily to funnel people of color into the criminal justice system, not to reduce drug crime. The third takeaway is America has labeled more than 20% of its population as criminals. The war on drugs led to a tremendous increase in prison sentences. In 1980, America's prison system held about 300,000 people behind bars. By 2000, more than 2 million found themselves incarcerated. By 2010, America's official crime rate roughly equaled that of Germany, but Germany jailed 93 of every 100,000 people, while the United States imprisoned 750. The United States had reached rates of incarceration by 2010 that exceeded even those of Russia, China, and Iran. The consequences of a conviction don't end with release from prison. As of 2008, when America held about 2.3 million people behind bars, an additional 5.1 million remained under correctional supervision, on probation or parole. In the United States, arrests can ruin your life, preventing you from living in public housing, finding a job, or obtaining a professional license. The fourth takeaway is the war on drugs cracked down hardest, by far, on African Americans and other people of color. Bias in enforcement and sentencing in the war on drugs has led to the overrepresentation of people of color in the penal system. The war on drugs caused prison admissions for black people to quadruple in 3 years during the 1980s. Between 1983 and 2000, the rates of prison admissions for whites increased eightfold, for Latinos, 22-fold, and for African Americans, 26-fold. By 1991, one in four African American men had passed through the system. In 2000, African Americans accounted for between 80 and 90% of drug-related prison sentences in seven states. In 15 states, blacks received prison sentences for drug charges at rates up to 57 times those of white men. Blacks and Latinos account for 3 out of every 4 people sent behind bars for drug offenses. However, drug use and drug sales occur at similar rates for all races. If anything, studies find that whites are more likely to use or sell illegal drugs than people of color. On a numerical basis, whites represent the overwhelming majority of drug users, while African Americans represent 15% of drug users. Data shows drug use among black people is no more dangerous or severe than drug use among whites. The fifth takeaway is law enforcement receives financial and other incentives to feed Americans into the penal system. Since the advent of the war on drugs, the federal government has supplied large-scale financial support, training, and military equipment to local and state law enforcement agencies. Funds available through federal programs depend upon the local agency's number of drug arrests. $153 per arrest in 2001. Local law enforcement agencies also profit from the drug war through forfeiture, the practice by which a law enforcement agency may seize cash and assets during drug operations, based on nothing more than suspicion of unlawful activity, and legally keep them for its own use. In response to these incentives, local and state law enforcement agencies have built up specialized narcotics task forces and engage in drug enforcement at volume. Officers employ tactics such as pretextual traffic stops, that is, stopping drivers for minor traffic infractions in order to obtain consent to search their vehicles. Consent searches, that is, searches that have no legal justification and occur only because the person volunteers consent, and stop and frisk, which means stopping people on the street to search them for weapons or drugs. Through tactics such as these, law enforcement agencies usher large numbers of people into the criminal justice system. Once there, the accused often find themselves denied legal representation and get caught up in a system of harsh sentencing and plea bargaining that gives them little chance of escaping without a conviction. The sixth takeaway is little legal recourse exists for people of color caught in America's penal system. A series of Supreme Court decisions has left people of color little defense against bias in law enforcement, prosecution, and sentencing. Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 prohibits discrimination in federally funded programs and activities, but because of the 2001 Alexander v. Sandoval decision, private victims of such discrimination can't sue in court. Only the federal government can. No driver will obey traffic rules all the time. If police can stop drivers for minor traffic violations and then investigate for drugs, they can arbitrarily check any driver, which, in practice, leads to discrimination. Wren v. United States specifically allows police to do just that. In McCleskey v. Kemp, a 1987 decision, the court ruled that claims of unlawful discrimination in sentencing brought under the 14th Amendment require a showing of conscious discriminatory intent, extremely difficult to produce, given that it would depend on a prosecutor's or juror's open admission of racial bias. The Armstrong decision in 1996 requires defendants to produce evidence that only the case can uncover before they can even bring the case to court. Perkett v. Elm, a 1995 decision, made it legal for prosecutors to strike black citizens from the jury pool as long as the prosecutor offered some non-racial reason. The person can be too young, for example, or too old, too comfortable, or too uncomfortable. Many criminal defendants lack legal representation of any kind. Around 80% can't afford a lawyer and thus depend on the public defender system. Yet some states set the income threshold so low, in Wisconsin, $3,000 per year, that few defendants qualify. Two, many public defender offices suffer from woefully low budgets and inadequate staffing, such as the Lake Charles, Louisiana office, which sees 2,500 felony cases every year and employs just two investigators. The seventh takeaway is the felon label distinguishes a new underclass in America. Prison populations have soared, but the United States caste system depends less on incarceration itself than on the significance of a felony record. Most felons never even go to prison, but the felon label follows people for life and ruins lives. People with a felony record find themselves unqualified for public housing or food stamps, subject to discrimination on the part of landlords and employers, ineligible for federal educational assistance and many professional licenses, and often deeply indebted for the cost of their journey through the penal system. In many cases, felons can't serve on juries and can't vote. They become subject to constant police surveillance and social stigma. Many lose custody of their children and fall into homelessness, and many felons become repeat offenders as a result of parole violations, such as missing a meeting with a parole officer, losing a job, or speaking to the wrong person on the street. Felons can thus find it difficult or impossible to reintegrate into society. The eighth takeaway is the idea of colorblindness has only facilitated the felon caste system. The ideal of colorblindness reflects a misunderstanding of Dr. Martin Luther King's vision of a society where race doesn't divide people. He didn't mean that people should pretend race doesn't exist. Indeed, he cautioned that blindness to race and indifference to racial groups constituted a spiritual blindness that made slavery and segregation possible. Because decent, sincere people couldn't or wouldn't see the consequences certain actions would bring for black people. Color blindness causes ignorance and indifference to the plight of people of color. Rather than color blindness, society needs greater color consciousness. Color blindness suggests that people can treat others with fairness and compassion without seeing race. Color consciousness reflects the faith that people can care about one another regardless of racial differences. Color consciousness would allow people to recognize racial and ethnic inequalities and to act to promote equality. The ninth takeaway is America needs more than criminal justice reform. It needs a moral transformation. Since the civil rights movement, racial justice advocacy has relied on civil rights litigation. But the solution to mass incarceration won't come through litigation. Reforming the criminal justice system would mean, for one thing, putting hundreds of thousands of people out of work, guards, administrators, and others. It would also slash the profits of wealthy and powerful incarceration capitalists and other profiteers. It would require ending the war on drugs and reforming policing. To do all this will require a new public consensus. Only a shift in public consciousness will ensure that the end of mass incarceration will mean the end of America's racial caste system. Without it, the system will only find a new form. Reform work will need to contribute to movement building and work towards societal transformation. Civil rights advocates should move beyond diversity-driven affirmative action to an all-of-us approach, care and concern for all people, including poor whites. As King advocated during the Poor People's Movement, racial justice advocates should shift from a civil rights paradigm to a human rights perspective, making it possible for poor and working class people across races to work together.